Hello, Mobilizers. It's season two, all brand new, with perception change on our radar. I'm Sheila Murphy, Chief Mobilizer for Mission to Mobilization, focused on changing the way you see returning citizens. And that is 4.5 million of them living in this country, with over 2.7 million children living with at least one incarcerated parent. The mission is possible. This season, we are hearing testimony from our community, professionals, employers, and family members. Our purpose is still the same, sharing returning citizens' success stories for the purpose of change perception, behaviors, and laws that affect these families and yours. The feedback on our battle plans have been a resounding yes. Certified health and well-being coach and author Nate Battle is helping us change our thinking and moving us to new methods of life management. You don't want to miss it. Now, this week, I said I was going to share something new. This is my focus and my concern. My call to this work will not allow me to diminish the challenges of returning citizens in the midst of very competing agendas. This work is still relevant, and I believe the relationships with law enforcement is as well. Some of you may be like me, where you know people from across varied communities. Well, I'm excited about today's guest. It's Sergeant Steve McCarty. He's got 28 years on the Minneapolis Police Department, and he's committed to our community and has a heart for change. Please help me welcome to the show Sergeant Steve McCarty. Hello, my brother.
Hi, how are you, Sheila?
I'm good. Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome.
I'm looking forward to our conversation about returning citizens. Let's get started.
Yes, please. So I wanted you to just talk briefly about your role on the force. You know, I've known you for years. Help our audience just to get to a better picture about who you are, your years of service, and maybe some varied assignments that you've had over the course of your career.
Well, Sheila, I think we met, was it in junior high or high school?
I think high school.
Yeah, so it's been, what, about 10, 15 years ago now, I guess.
That's right.
I've been on the Minneapolis Police Department for 28 years. I'm currently assigned to the patrol division. Minneapolis has 5 police precincts, and I'm in the first precinct, which basically covers our downtown area.
Okay.
And I'm a patrol supervisor, so I supervise a shift of 17 officers. And it's similar to what you might see on TV, you know, riding around in a police car, that kind of stuff, going to 911 calls. I've been in that assignment for like the last 2 years. Prior to that, I was a sergeant assigned to the assault unit where I investigated felony assault, where people would get shot or stabbed that didn't die. They weren't homicides, that is.
So okay.
Those cases would be investigated also. So I did that for 4 years.
Hmm.
Prior to that, I was the postman for the Minneapolis Police Department for approximately 3 years. We call it a public information officer. In that job, you get public statements to news media outlets and things of that nature, radio, TV, that kind of stuff.
Oh.
Let's see. Before that, I was in internal affairs as a sergeant assigned to the internal affairs unit. And internal affairs unit, as I'm sure all your listeners know, investigate the police for allegations of misconduct. I did that for 2 years. Prior to that, I was a juvenile sergeant investigator for approximately a year.
Okay.
And before I got promoted, I was a street officer for 17 years in 2 different precincts. 1 precinct, which is North Minneapolis and in the city, and the first precinct, which was downtown, as I mentioned earlier. So I've had a few transfers over the years.
Yes, a very exciting and a wide range of different types of work, which I love. I didn't realize that about you. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, sure.
Now, you know, I've never asked you this, but why law enforcement? What inspired you to get involved in this type of work?
Well, probably my father, first and foremost. My dad, he was in the Air Force, and when he got out of the Air Force, he became a correctional officer. In Ramsey County, which is St. Paul's in Ramsey County, for your listeners. You know, I mean, he would talk about his experiences at work, and although it was corrections, I mean, it's very similar to law enforcement. So I think that's probably my primary influence. I was also influenced by the need for have more representation of law enforcement officers that resemble the community.
Okay.
you know, and that was a big part of it too. And I knew I wanted to work in a larger city, whether it was one of the two twin cities in Minneapolis. I got hired by them first. And I think those two factors were first and foremost.
Okay. Now, I know that there's a number of challenges that I'm sure that you could talk about over the course of your career, but I wanted to know, you know, what you would say would be the most challenging part of your job and then some rewards as well.
Okay. Well, you know, if I had to name the most challenging part, I would say probably the internal politics that go along with any organization. Police departments are like paramilitary organizations, so there can be a lot of bureaucracy involved in some of the decisions that are made, and you know they affect everybody in the rank and file. Obviously, the lower down you are, the less of an impact that it has. But nevertheless, I think some of those decisions that are made, and some of the reasons why these decisions are made, might not be understood by the rank and file, because usually admin people are making them. Your chiefs, your assistant chiefs, your commanders, your higher ranking people, not to mention the mayor and the city council in these cities. So there's a lot of back and forth, and that can be kind of frustrating if you let it get to you. You know, I mean, I guess to segue into some of the positives, I mean, I try not to focus on what the internal politics are. I just try to go out and do the best job I can for the people that I come in contact with on the street and the people that I work with. So, you know, there's certain things that we can't control. So it doesn't really do a whole lot of good to get bent out of shape over stuff.
Okay.
You know, that you can't control.
Right.
That's my philosophy. So you just look at the bigger picture, and the job is to help the public and act accordingly and treat people fairly.
Yes. And I think when I think about treating people fairly, I think that is so important. And sometimes it may be challenging to do that, you know, in environments where sometimes you're having to make decisions very quickly or have to discern kind of what is going on. And I didn't ask you or wasn't thinking that I was going to ask you this, but I did want to know a little bit about your year with working with youth. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. There again, I was a new sergeant promoted to that rank, and I was assigned to the juvenile unit. And, you know, basically, it was investigating juveniles that were, whether they were victims or suspects of crimes. So it was investigating juvenile crimes. But that was one aspect of it. But I think my years and 17 years as a patrol officer, now that I've been back for 2 years, you know, you come in contact with juveniles typically on a less adversarial encounters.
Okay.
And I can explain that when you're investigating them, you know, typically they've done something wrong, or it's perceived that they've done something wrong. So, you know, you're interviewing them about, you know, possible criminal activity, where, believe it or not, when you're in a patrol car, especially in some of the neighborhoods, I'm in a downtown area now, so you don't really have the neighborhoods, but, you know, you might see some kids throwing a football around or shooting some hoops or something. You know, I mean, I used to stop and throw the ball with them and try to shoot some baskets with them, you know. And,
okay.
I mean, a lot of times it caught kids off guard because, you know, I wish more of our police officers would do that. And some do it, but, you know, whenever you can make these positive impacts with these kids that aren't necessarily law enforcement related, you know, it just helps build the ties with the people of our community. Because for one thing, like I said, most people don't expect that.
Right. But, and you're building relationships. Right.
Yeah, building relationships, right. Yeah.
Exactly.
And, you know, and there again, here I'm probably generalizing, but it might happen a little more often than I perceive it. You know, every once in a while you see a video of, you know, some uniformed police officers getting out of their squad car and, you know, doing line dances with kids or, you know, shooting baskets or something like that. And those are great videos that, you know, we see them on YouTube every once in a while. They'll put them on the news, you know. I mean, you know, it's important to kind of work with everybody you come in contact with and not always have it being in a crisis situation.
Exactly. Right. And being able to show that the positive aspect of the work that you're doing as an officer in communities that you serve.
You're right.
Exactly. That's good. I want to switch gears a little bit, and I want to talk about your relationship with returning citizens, because obviously that is the work that I'm doing and why one of the reasons why I wanted you to come and speak to our audience. I know that all returning citizens are not created equal. Every individual, but specifically returning citizens, do not want to be necessarily rehabilitated or do not want to change. But we have a number of them that really are doing phenomenal, remarkable work post-incarceration. And you mentioned someone, and I wanted you to talk about this individual and just speak to our audience to let them know something about your relationship with this person, and then maybe some characteristics that you could describe about this returning citizen that you have observed over the years.
Yeah, sure. We'll call him Joe for the sake of the programs. I don't want to identify him for, I'm sure, reasons, you know, we all understand, but.
Sure.
I met Joe, I don't know, maybe around 5 years ago. Met him, and I think it was at church. I can't remember when I met Joe, but I met him, and, you know, he was kind of streetwise, for lack of better descriptions, and I think he had done some time in prison before I met him, and he was out.
Okay.
Well, it turned out that Joe had another encounter where he got arrested by the police and was in a motor vehicle. And when they caught him, they thought he had some drugs on him, some narcotics. So long story short, he went to trial, lost, and got some more time. So Joe got out around, he pled guilty. So rather than taking his trial, and as I'm sure, you know, your listeners know, if you plead guilty, you're most likely going to get less time than if you go through court and then they find you guilty. Go through a trial and they find you guilty. So he spent a couple more years in jail and got out. And Joe let me know that he was out and looking for a place to live. Joe had like 4 or 5 kids. And you know, he was very active in his children's life before he went in and after he got out. So he was looking for a place to live. So he came to me and asked me if I could help him. Well, I helped him find a place to live. And Joel's working now. He joined the church, got baptized. And Joel is doing very well considering the circumstances that he came from. So, you know, we hear negative things about returning citizens, people that were in prison, ex-felon, whatever you want to call them. But, you know, you can't treat everybody the same, just like Black people don't want to be treated the same. All cops don't want to be treated the same or painted with a broad brush.
Right.
You have to look at the individual and get to know them.
Exactly. And could you maybe give 3 characteristics, you know, of who you'd say Joe is today?
He's a good father.
Okay.
He's employed.
Okay.
And he's a churchgoer.
Okay. That's good. Thank you. Now, I know because you've watched Joe as well as many others just in your work and, but just in your general life, you've seen a lot of the challenges that returning citizens face post-incarceration. What would you say are some of the key issues that they're dealing with?
You know, I think it's just, we have a tendency, and I think we all do this, we have a tendency to cast the same broad, you know, treat everybody the same. You know, just, he's a felon, you know, he's not going to change. I think the stereotypes that people have, and we all have them, I think that hurts them the most instead of getting to know the people for what they are. You know, I mean, I think the vast majority, and I don't have, I'm speaking anecdotally here, and you could probably tell me this, Sheila, but I think the vast majority of people don't reoffend. Recidivism. Yeah. I mean, is that true? I mean, the majority of people don't go back to prison.
It depends on their support system. So typically, if they're not getting support within that first year post incarceration, the recidivism rate goes up.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't know that. So okay, the key is getting help to help stay away from what got them there in the first place.
Exactly. And I was thinking about your relationship with Joe And really, it kind of ties into my next question about you, why, you know, you were willing to help him. And I wanted you to take your police hat off and just speak just as a human being. But, you know, what was your reasoning? What really kind of was at the core of you and your thinking about why you wanted to help Joe?
Well, he's a very likable guy. You met Joe. I mean, he's a very likable guy. I think he also does some stand-up comedy, too, so maybe that kind of helps.
Right.
The guy's pretty funny, actually.
Okay.
So that's part of it. And then, you know, I have a sense of, you know, I mean, the man came to me for help, you know?
Okay.
And I don't know. I guess I have a hard time saying no if somebody, I feel they're genuinely wanting some help and I can help them. Maybe it's my upbringing, I don't know. But, you know, I mean, I just think if you can help somebody and they are genuine and they want help, why not help them, you know, or do what you can for them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't cost anything.
Right. You know? Right. You know, well, right. It is the right thing to do. And, you know, Steve, I would even say that it seems free, but a lot of people do feel like their time is a cost, you know, that they're paying with their time, or they're, you know, if someone is asking them to help them find a job, that their reputation is at risk. And so there is somewhat of a cost. But I think depending on the perspective, your perspective, and I believe mine as well, that we believe that is something that we pay forward, that people have done for us, have given us chances and opportunities. Yeah. And so why wouldn't we do the same thing?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know where I'd be if it wasn't for, you know, I mean, not only my family, certain family members, but, you know, I mean, people outside my family who, you know, gave me a chance, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, I could have ended up anywhere. You know, it's only by the grace of God that I haven't had more people in my way that helped me, you know, to have trouble, you know?
Right. And everyone has gotten help in some kind of way. When people, a lot of times people say, oh, no one helped me, I did it on my own, they're not telling the truth. Because someone had to help you. Even if someone gave you a job, the person that gave you the job helped you get the job. They didn't have to say yes. Right, exactly.
Yeah, I agree completely.
So I want to switch to a tougher subject because since I have you and you're on the police force and you can see the number of challenges that we have with our communities and the police, I want to get your perspective. I just want to just open up the floor for you to talk about what you're seeing and what you think about what's happening.
General, or
your perspective on the conflicts that are going on with some random shootings, obviously police officers that have been on camera killing someone, yet they get let go. And so our community is angry. I mean, obviously families are hurting because of this. And so you're wearing a different hat. And so I want to hear what your thoughts are, as much or less as you want to share or you feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah, okay. Well, I can share some stuff. I've got some thoughts on that.
Okay.
You know, of course, there's a long historical count with the police and the black community or African American. I mean, and I'm sure your listeners know, you know, I mean, the police were once slave catchers and they involved into police departments, you know, and that racism that happened, you know, I mean, it's not going to be erased over hundreds of years, obviously, you know, but yeah, I can say in my 28 years, I think things have gotten better. You know, they're still not as good as they could be because of discrimination and the racism and that stuff that not only perpetuates law enforcement encounters, but just in every aspect in this country, you know, I mean, there's a lot of racism and discrimination against people of color, white people, African Americans. You know, and it's just, of course, when you have encounters with the police department, you know, the outcome can be a lot more devastating than it can be if you're, you know, going for a job interview. Because, I mean, with armed police, you know, they, you know, can kill people, justified or not, you know. So having said that, I think some of the keys to kind of eliminate some of this racism are numbers. I mean, you need more numbers on these police departments, you know, more black people on these police departments to police in some of these areas, and I think that would help. I also think that racist they are. They probably, and I'm just speaking in general terms here, Sheila, but they might say, well, you know, I mean, if these black people are killing each other and victimizing each other, why should I care?
Hmm.
You know, you look at some cities, you know, and some of the black-on-black crime is just phenomenal,
you know.
I mean, even here in Minneapolis, you know.
Right.
So I think until certain segments of the black community, and it's certainly not all segments, I think it's a small number of people within our own community that perpetuate these crimes against each other. I think, you know, if we could stop some of that black-on-black crime, I think that would help the overall picture.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, but until that time, I mean, yes, we have seen, you know, white police officers have shot black people in questionable circumstances, and now that, you know, everybody, most of these departments have these body cameras, and everybody has a cell phone video, you know, you're seeing that. But one thing I've noticed, though, some of these, you know, questionable shootings, these police officers, well, most of them are becoming ex-police officers, are getting charged with these crimes now. So, I mean, they're making steps in the right direction to try to eliminate or at least slow down some of the questionable police shootings.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. But there again, you know, and I, like I said, you're talking to a 28-year police officer here, and I try to do my job best of my ability. You know, not all these police shootings are unjustified.
You said all of them are not.
Are not.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know. But yes, the ones that, you know, appear to be clearly unjustified are definitely wrong. And, you know, I mean, I'm a Christian, and I believe that, you know, we're all going to have to answer for the stuff that we've done here, you know, with self included, you know. So, mm-hmm. So there's always going to be, there'll be a higher authority. So.
Definitely. And
that's how I feel about that.
No, that's really good. And it's a great perspective, and it's yours, you know, and I mean, and that's what I, obviously you cannot speak for every police officer. You're speaking just from your own heart, your own experience. And I respect that, you know, and it really, I was thinking about when you said that the police departments there's been some things that have improved over the course of the years. And, you know, it just reminds me that everything is not captured on TV. You know, just like there's a lot of negative things that we're capturing, but there's a whole lot of positive things that are not being captured. And so we end up getting a very narrow perspective about what's happening in our communities when we only get a 30-second soundbite or, you know, somebody's cell phone clip that, whether it was something good or bad. But typically, we're not getting good stories. I mean, we don't share a lot of good stories, and we don't talk about those. So that is what hurts us in the relationship, in one of the relationships that we have, I think, with the police. And so, my last question or conversation part of our conversation, I wanted to talk about what you thought about a partnership between returning citizens and police to help improve relations and safety. You know, some may say that it wouldn't work, but I would love to hear maybe a couple of two or three pros on how you think it could work well.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, before I answer that, I just got one more thing to say about this. What you said, you brought up an interesting point, Sheila, about, you know, not hearing the full story and all that stuff from the media. You know, not to blame the media, but I am going to blame them because they do that intentionally. You know, I mean, anything that can ignite, you know, conversation or, you know, dissension or whatever, the media capitalizes on that. That's ratings for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they talk about, you know, a white police officer killed, you know, black man, unarmed black man, you know, that, and they have a 30-second soundbite on it or whatever, you know, and show some people protesting, that's going to get people worked up.
Right.
So they do that on purpose. You know, they don't, and here I'm speaking in general terms again, but that would sell more papers than, or mm-hmm. have more TV ratings than the cop shooting basketball with the kid.
Right.
You know, playing basketball with the kid. You know?
That's true.
So I think a lot of that is intentional on their part to, you know, sell stories and get people, you know, worked up. I mean, you can look at any time the president makes a statement, you know, I mean, you know, you can say what you want about the guy, you know, I mean, I'm not talking politics here, but they always make him, you know, Hulk sound like he's crazy, you know?
Right.
I mean,
I was going to say, but right.
You know, I mean, he doesn't help his cause.
No,
but,
no.
And it gets people worked up, you know, on each side, you know?
And it goes back. It goes back to my point about every word or every incident is not captured and it's not publicized. So we don't, know any good thing that is being said or any good thing or good work that all the good things that are being said and done. If we're only hearing the snapshots of all the negative. And so we have to be really careful. And I think that it's important for us as responsible viewers and listeners that we are doing a better job at judging what we see and knowing sometimes we're not getting the full truth.
Yeah, right, exactly. But I don't think, and I'm speaking in general terms again, most of it, I mean, I don't like to read papers.
Right.
So I'll say myself, you know, I get the sound bite and go from that, you know, but we have to be better educated. I have to be better educated and dig down into it and get as many facts as I can.
Exactly. And really, the purpose of this show, of Mission Possible, really is about telling positive stories, because I believe that there's not enough when we look at all of the negative things, the negative perceptions and stereotypes, biases that there are about returning citizens, that I believe that this platform was developed to be able to tell positive stories and to share that there are some good things going on in the lives of returning citizens, their families, and the communities that they serve. So. Yes, yes.
Okay,
so lastly, right.
To your question,
yes.
Positive things that can result in a police returning citizens partnership?
Yes.
Well, I think it would break down barriers. It would break down barriers on both sides. You know, if you have the right people, you know, the right officers, you know, open-minded, who would be willing to partner with returning citizens and not, you know, think that they're all the same. You know, they're not going to change. They're going to end up back in prison, blah, blah, blah. You have to have an open mind. And the returning citizens have to have an open mind and think that, to know that, you know, hey, these officers aren't just trying to, you know, get me jammed up again. You know, they're not out to get me.
Right.
So there again, you got to have open-minded people who are willing to work. I think it would be a great thing, you know, a great partnership.
Great. That's good. Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm testing the theory, and we'll see what we can do with that. So.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. So this is it. I typically ask individuals if they had something, one thing that they'd want to say about returning citizens or to share, if they had the opportunity to speak into the hearts and minds and homes of every nation or the people within the nation. What would be one thing that you would want us to hear about returning citizens, or one thing you'd want to say?
Just, you know, you get multiple chances in your life. Make the most of them. And if you need help, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's places where returning citizens can go to get help. So you get chances, lots of chances in this life. Take them and use them for the best possible thing that you can get out of it.
Okay. Well, good. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This was a very enlightening conversation. I learned so much more about you, but then also just the perspective from the police, from a person that is a police officer. And I think that our audience will definitely has been enlightened and will learn some things and be able to take that into their lives as we move forward to be more educated and more have a greater perspective around police as well as the work that we're doing with returning citizens. So I thank you. I thank you for the time, and I thank you for your transparency as well.
Well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me to talk, and I appreciate it. And good luck with your mission and everything. And if there's anything else I can help you with, let me know.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much. Okay. I will talk to you soon.
All right.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, you human. Coach Nate here with today's battle plan. Today I want to talk about small things. There's a Chinese proverb that goes, "The man who removes a mountain begins by carrying away small stones." As with many proverbs, that requires a little bit of interpretation, definition, and further looking into. If we look at small things, the 30-some-odd trillion cells that make up the human body, the oceans comprised of drops of water, too many to count, the beaches, grains of sand, the effect of splitting a single atom and the energy that releases and the chain reaction that that causes. It's the small things that matter. If we look at, as we've talked in the past about the thought process, we first develop a thought, then we develop an emotion around that thought, and that then turns into a behavior. I credit Dr. Caroline Leaf with that concept, theory, analogy in her book, Who Switched Off My Brain? So if we're looking to, for example, change our behaviors, it begins with thought, a small thought. If we're looking to move a mountain of hatred, it begins with a single act of kindness, a single thought of love. If we're looking to overcome, tunnel through a mountain of negativity, it begins with a single positive action. It's the little things that matter, not necessarily the big things. And too often we look at our behaviors, our plans, waiting until, when, looking into the future, and not doing anything about the here and the now that we could, removing things a pebble at a time. Some will say, well, that's an overbearing effort. That's too much. I'm going to move a mountain a pebble at a time. The mountain's going to be there. It's not going anywhere until it begins. Until we begin to do something about it. If we have an obstacle in front of us, let's say we're tired, we are depleted, this has been going on for so long, demoralized, perhaps even depressed over it, don't have that mammoth energy for massive action. But what you can do is something small. Changing your thought pattern, replacing a negative thought with a positive thought. It's more than just an idiom to, well, that's just positive talk and that doesn't last. No, that then can set off a chain reaction, much like splitting an atom. A single thought won't do it. A single atom split doesn't do it. But in the right circumstances, the power that happens of the chain reaction when you split that atom is monumental. So if you're looking for a better life, if you're looking to enhance or improve your life, start there. It's not the outside. It's not the other people. It's not necessarily moving people in and out of your life. In some cases, it does mean unfriending them in real life or on social media. But it really begins with you, in your thought patterns, in your actions. If you are operating on a higher frequency, because you've done so many small things that have set off a chain reaction to build up a resistance to the negative, you now have a force field against those things and they no longer impact you. If you have set off a chain reaction in your belief patterns, you're no longer persuaded or controlled by that used to control you. If you have thought different thoughts about who you are, not allowing others to define that, when they attempt to, that will no longer have an impact on you because you know that you know that you know who you are, whose you are, who created you, and what your capability is. I could go on for hours. My point here, it's the small things. If you want to move the obstacle, the mountain, start with the small things. In thoughts, in actions. Where there are negative, go positive. Where they're bad, do good. Replace. Don't continue. What is it? Insanity, doing the same thing, expecting different results by doing the same thing. That's insanity. In this instance, do something different, but start small. That's within your realm, regardless of how tired you are. That's within your reach to be able to do. And watch it build. Watch yourself tunnel through the mountain. Build a bridge between them, or remove it altogether. Life exists in the small things. Until next time, this is Coach Nate. Live your best life on purpose now.
Thanks, Coach. Today I want us to enlarge our reach and enhance our thinking. There's always more than one way to think about one situation. If you want to have something you've never had before, you must do something you've never done. If you want to feel safer about returning citizens, you will have to get new information with a better interpretation. Here are three words I want you to take with you today. Educate, initiate, and eliminate. Educate yourself with independent and trustworthy sources. Initiate new conversations about positive returning citizens you know. And eliminate from your mind negative stereotypes about people and circumstances you cannot confirm. Your change matters. Buying for returning citizens, walk-a-month workshops, and returning citizen-friendly congregations. This is Mission Possible, and I'm Sheila Murphy. Visit missiontomobilization.com to check out our work, and visit natebattle.com for today's battle plan. Until next time,
create your battle plan
and make your mission possible.